While everyone was out trick-or-treating this past weekend, or dressing up as their favorite not PG-13 cat or elf or whatever your favorite Halloween costume is, the WNBA continued its Cold War. The league is currently in the middle of a very fractious collective bargaining negotiation. And it's about time I did an episode about this, and I want to have on the two best WNBA writers in the whole goddamn country to talk about this very interesting, sensitive, and potentially debilitating moment for the WNBA and its players. So on this episode of Business Decision, Ben Pickman, Sabrina Merchant, my two colleagues at The Athletic, are coming onto the show, and we're talking about what is the great WNBA Cold War and where it goes from here. Ben, Sabrina, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for the invite on a time that I could actually talk to you, Mike.
You're saying that as if me sending an invite for a podcast, the last one that Ben was on, right before a WNBA Finals game was a bad idea. And I just disagree.
I mean, game five of the semifinals. But still, when I was in Las Vegas to cover said game, feels like a bad idea.
Okay. That's fair.
I'm honored to be. Am I the first ever repeat guest on this show, Mike? I'm honored if so.
And as someone deserving that honor, I want you to tell everyone, what did you run the New York City Marathon in this past weekend?
Yes, I did run the New York City Marathon. I ran a personal best. I ran 3 hours, 24 minutes, and 2 seconds. Shaved a couple minutes off my time last year. Not my overall marathon best. I set that earlier this fall at the Berlin Marathon. Yeah, it was a pretty amazing day. Thank you to all the people who support all the runners, not just myself, but more importantly, the 59,000 others who also run. Truly the best day.
Wonderful. I sat on my couch for 3 hours and 24 minutes this Sunday, so we both achieved the personal best. Ben, Sabrina, we're in the middle of what I'd like to say is overtime for this 2020 WNBA CBA. The Players Union and the WNBA had their CBA agreement set to end on October 31st. Both of you reported that they got a 30-day extension. So we're now in OT. We got an extra end of this month, basically, until there's either a lockout or a strike. Things are not pretty for the WNBA and its players right now. There's a lot of public sniping. I'm sure even more sniping behind the scenes. Kathy Engelbert is not very well liked, as we know, by WNBA players. Adam Silver is now catching some heat as well. I want to know, we're recording this November 4th, 1:37 p.m. Eastern time. Things may change quickly, so I just want to put the time on there. Where do you guys think the state of the W and its CBA talks are right now?
I think, you know, it was positive that they agreed to an extension at the end of last week. I think that was the one thing that both sides can agree on, that did show some willingness to collaborate and work together and show some progress. I think it was a very strained process to get to that point. I think even as of the middle and early last week, it was unclear if the Players Association was going to accept the extension offer that that the league had proposed. And we now know, and we reported this as well, that, you know, there's this 48-hour termination clause that either side has that the Players Association asked for as part of the extension, that basically was a condition of accepting the extension, that they can opt out of this extension within 48 hours notice. And that to me is like another way to maintain some leverage and is another example of like, yeah, we want to collaborate, but we also want the eject button in case we need to push that over the next 30 days. Like, it still is very much a contentious negotiation. And I know we're going to get into that. And I don't think that changes despite the extension getting signed, but I do think it is at least a show of like willingness to want to continue to good faith bargain that they were able to agree to that 30-day extension just before Halloween.
I would have interpreted it more as good faith had there not been the 48-hour opt-outs on both sides. To me, it was more the players trying not to lose face. Like, oh, the league did us, you know, tried to get out a good public message like, hey, we are willing to continue this negotiation for an additional 30 days. Like, we'll offer the 30-day extension. But now the players have to take it to make it look like, oh, we're not the ones who are holding up the process, right? And that's why now you have the opt-out to be like, okay, we agreed to the extension, but, like, that doesn't necessarily mean that we believe in all of the terms that are on the table right now.
It is interesting how this has quickly become, and I mean, maybe this is where it was always going to get to, but it's also partially a PR war, right? And that's part of kind of what any CBA negotiation usually does become if it's not something where they reach a deal a year out, like say the NHL did. I found that interesting in that I think based on public polling, I think the Seton Hall University had a poll recently that showed that the support seemed to be on the player side, which is very rare. I think you very rarely see fans siding with the players in any labor talks. And to me, is the big overarching thing about this is the most important winter offseason, whatever you want to call it, in the NBA's history, right? Like, aside from the CBA talks, you have everyone becoming a free agent. The economics of the league are about to change. You're going to have probably mass player movement across teams once everyone is able to do that. You have two expansion teams who have to draft their rosters. But none of that happens without a CBA in place. And so that's a lot of underlying anxiety, I would say, for this to come. And as we stand right now, again, early November, do you get a sense of who's got the better standing right now? Like, Sabrina, who would you say has the upper hand in this negotiation right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird the way you want to like frame that, because on the one hand, I agree with you. Like, the fact that the players have public opinion on their side is definitely different than other professional sports negotiations. Like, anytime there's a lockout in men's professional sports, you see fans slowly start to turn on the athletes because they just want their games to start up again. And it's hard to empathize with players who are making millions and millions of dollars, willing to sit out, you know, for more millions and millions of dollars. And I think the WNBA's positioning is a little different in this respect because they're more relatable. Like, you make a similar salary to a WNBA player. Like, you can understand what they're fighting for, relatively speaking. And yet, like, the players just, in my opinion, can't hold out as long as the owners can, because for all of the money that is coming into the WNBA, the effect on their balance sheets, like, that the WNBA is making, I don't think is going to hurt the owners in the same way that it is going to hurt the players. So I think the owners in the league just have a longer runway here where, like, they can afford to pinch and squeeze a little bit more and sort of wait for the players, you know, to come closer to them on their terms. So I think, you know, despite the fact that, like, this is a more, like, this union has more solidarity, I think, than most, and has a stronger public bargaining position than most. Unfortunately, I still think the labor doesn't have as much power in this negotiation as the owners do. And it also, like, sort of, I'm not sure that either side really has enough to, like, really squeeze the other yet, because we just have so much time until the season actually starts, yeah. Right? Like, technically, like, you want to get an expansion draft done, you want to get free agency done, you want to get the college draft done, but, like, until we get to, you know, a point where games in May, which is still 6 months away, are in jeopardy, like, I don't know that either side really has a ton of leverage over the other, because there is still such a long runway.
And we should say that past agreements, you know, CBA agreements that the league has signed, even in different economic times for the league, took until the new calendar year to be agreed upon, right? The 2020 agreement was signed in January. The 2014 CBA agreement was signed in February. So the fact that there was not an agreement signed at the end of October, despite seemingly a desire for that to be the deadline and to reach a new agreement, it's not really a surprise. Even in different conditions, it took a couple extra months to reach a new deal. I do think what is also different about the context in the WNBA CBA negotiation is players are used to a viable alternative from the WNBA in a way that, say, in the NBA context, NBA players are not used to just, you know, going over to play in EuroLeague instead of the WNBA, right? Like, back in the 2011 lockout, I think we all remember Deron Williams going over to play for Beşiktaş in Turkey. And that was such a big deal because, like, name another NBA player in his prime at that time who's going over to play in Turkey. You probably can't do that. Whereas in the WNBA context, you have some of the best players in the world who routinely spend their winters collecting second checks or first checks, because in many cases, they're more lucrative than the WNBA salaries that they make in Europe, in EuroLeague or Euro Cup competition. And now, of course, you also have Unrivaled, where, you know, so many players are getting $200,000 to $250,000 or more, and you have so many of the best players there who, yeah, they might not be making millions in that league, but they're certainly collecting income. They're staying in the U.S. They're working on their brand deals. Like, they at least can plan to have that check coming in. And so that is another interesting wrinkle just in terms of the economics that is underlying this, not even to get into what Unrivaled does from a player experience standpoint. And I know that's another tangent we could certainly go down later in this conversation.
Josh Childress, yeah, I mean, right? I think he went to Europe.
He did. I think he went to Greece.
Went to Greece, yeah.
Yeah. Let's play. Do you remember this guy? No, it's important. I mean, I think playing, do you remember where they played during the 2011 lockout is a fun game that maybe we can do at the end of this.
I want to say he played at like Panathinaikos or something, Childress.
That sounds about right. Yeah, before he started his real estate empire. Mm. I think a lot of people think of like what can either side gain during these negotiations, right? I think for the first time, maybe for the players in WNBA history, each side has a lot to lose. I understand the players are fighting for pay equity, right? And they want to see salary raises in the next CBA, which I totally get because right now the max salary is roughly like $235,000, give or take a few thousand there. I'm probably off by a little bit. But I think you guys reported last month that the max salary in the last offer was somewhere around $830,000, right? Which is a substantial raise. That's a level of salary we've never seen in professional women's sports in America before. Obviously, still significantly below what we see men's athletes make in pro sports, but also the revenue levels for the leagues are different. And for the NBA, there's a lot at stake for them too. Like the league has a lot of momentum right now, right? Like look at the valuations. They're skyrocketing. Ratings are awesome. Even without Caitlin Clark, ratings were great for the WNBA. Like the ratings for the NBA are on a downward trend. The ratings for men's college basketball are on a downward trend. The ratings for women's basketball, it's up and to the right, right? So both sides have incentive to have some loss aversion here. And I'm curious, like, which one do you think gets pushed more into making a deal because of that? Would it be for the NBA to sustain this momentum for the league, for the valuations of all their teams? And you know that maybe the league is still losing money. I'm sure that the NBA would claim that it is and that teams are losing money. But when we see teams sell for $250 million for an expansion team, we see an offer for the Connecticut Sun in the state of Connecticut, in Uncasville, Connecticut, where nobody actually wants to keep the team in Uncasville, Connecticut, get $325 million offers. Like there's real value there for the owners. Which side has more to lose here? Is it the owners or is it the players?
Well, I think we should first say as like point of clarification, both sides want significant salary increases in the next agreement, right? You mentioned it, the max salary currently is $250,000 around that. In the current deal, in an earlier, it's no longer the most recent, but in a relatively recent around the finals proposal that the league submitted, they submitted a max salary that was around $850,000, where, you know, I've used the term wedge issue, which is a term that Sabrina has started to make fun of me about because I have it in like all of my stories. You know, the conflict really comes down to how do you come up with the salary framework in the next agreement, right? That currently in the WNBA, unlike in the NBA, the salary cap is a fixed number. It is written into the contract that let's say it's $1 million and then it would increase by 3% the next year and then it would increase another 3% no matter how well the business does. The players are proposing a model where they want the salary cap to grow, you know, at a rate that is tied to the growth of the business. So when you throw out all those growth metrics, Mike, like they want to have the salary cap grow with the business. And if the cap grows with the business, like, and the revenue share grows with the business, then the
which
money
is how
trickles.
It works, by the way, just
going to
say,
like other leagues
in
work
NFL,
like this.
The NHL and the NBA, which are all the other cap professional sports leagues.
Right. Whereas in the current WNBA framework, it doesn't work like that. And so the league seemingly is proposing something that is more similar to what they currently have, where yes, that salary number for players, whatever that net number is, will be significantly more than what it is now, but it might not grow with the business as all of those other growth metrics that you threw out kind of trickle down into the league as directly. So that is the I guess, issue at hand. I don't know. Sabrina, do you want to talk about the work stoppage, potential consequences or the leverage play now that we established that, or we should...
Yeah. I mean, I could talk for another 30 minutes about revenue sharing, but I guess I could go with the leverage.
Let's talk about revenue sharing. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fascinating. you know, women's sports historically have not had salary caps tied to revenue because, I mean, frankly, revenue wasn't coming in at a rate to justify that sort of structure. I mean, when the CBA was signed in 2020, the fact that the WNBA players got a salary cap that wasn't tied to revenue actually ended up being a boon for the first couple of years of it because 2020, there was no league revenue essentially during the pandemic season when they played in the bubble in South Florida. And then you have 2021 when it was a pandemic affected season, I will say, where a lot of arenas weren't even taking in fans for most of the year and revenue was down again, like almost negligible. So the fact that they were consistently getting increasing salaries, although 3% versus inflation, you could quibble with whether they were increasing or not, was a measure of stability that like wasn't necessarily guaranteed by the way the WNBA business was doing. But now they're in a position where, hey, like the business is actually really doing well and we no longer want a revenue sharing model where currently you have to hit a cumulative target. And then once that target is hit, any extra revenue is put into revenue sharing. Like that just doesn't seem like it's going to work for what the players are trying to do. And that's why I think like the salary numbers are kind of like missing the point here. Like it's one thing for the league to say like, oh, we're giving you such a big raise, $850,000. But like if the WNBA doubles in revenue again over the next 3 years, then the fact that like they're getting to $850,000 as like this made up number doesn't really paint the picture of like how the WNBA's business is affecting the players, right? Like I think Nafisa Collier said this ad nauseum when they were starting Unrivaled, right? Like women's basketball, the growth is being felt by everybody but the players, which is why they started the league, right? So they could benefit in all of the explosion in sponsorships and ads and tickets and, you know, TV deals and all that. So yeah, I think the idea that like the WNBA seems content with just, oh, hey, like if we hit all of these targets, and again, like we don't even know what the targets are. We don't know what the revenue is, right? Like there's so little transparency with the WNBA's numbers that it's hard to know if these targets are achievable, if they like are logically correct with like the growth of the business. So I don't think that the WNBA is going to get to a point where like we're at a 50-50 split with the NBA. Like that just seems unreasonable. You know, there is a certain amount of the owners have to cover their losses from recent years and they have to feel incentivized to want to invest in business. But like to not even approach, hey, like let's give 15% to the WNBA players and like escalate based on targets just seems like, I don't know, like unreasonable considering where the league is right now.
Well, I do think like we don't know all the specifics too of all the proposals. I think we should say that and make that clear too. I think what is so interesting building off what you just said too, Sabrina, though, is like, is there a point where the players say, well, that salary number, even if it is, you know, it is from a framework that it has a more fixed component, is so much higher than we currently get paid that we're willing to make that concession on this agreement, right? I don't think there's anyone who thinks that the max salary for a player, or I certainly don't think, let me put it that way, that the max salary, you know, will be $850,000. I think in the course of a negotiation, if you think about how negotiations work, labor negotiations or any other kind of negotiation, you know, this is still an early stage part of the process. They throw out an $850,000 number. I think there's an assumption that it will increase in time. What I wonder though is there a point where that number that the league offers is so substantial and so substantially more than what players currently get paid that players are willing to say, and the union is willing to say, look, we will basically take this offer for a significant pay raise, even if the framework is not what we want, because this is a big jump. We recognize how significant that is, and we don't want to miss games, even if it means that over the next X number of years, their salary is not going to grow with the business in the way that they want. Like, I think that's really where the tension of this negotiation over the next couple months, kind of, I think that's a fair timeline. Like, that's what it comes down to me about.
I love that you call this an early part of the process when they opted out on October 31st, 2024. Yeah. Like, if this is a offer that came in on October 1st of 2025, like, how is that early? Like, what were we doing for the last 11 months?
Oh, come on, Sabrina, you don't file your story a month ahead of time. None of us do. I wait until a week after I instill to file. No, but your point stands. Your point stands. Yeah, I get what you're saying. I think I would guess like the NBA also in its head understands that probably the max salary can get to over $1 million. The question being, is that sufficient, right? Like, mm-hmm. Is that sufficient with where the economics of the league is? And my question too is not just what are the numbers in the CBA, it's how long is the CBA? I think the length of the term really matters more so than any other league. If the league is really on the ascent, as it is, as all of us have reported, as the players say, as the WNBA and the NBA say, I think it's in the players' best interest, isn't it, to get a shorter CBA? You want to be able to come back to the negotiating table. I mean, heck, take the media rights deal, right? Like, after 3 years, the league gets a chance to go back to all of its media rights partners and say, well, what do you think about giving us more money? let's build on that $2.2 billion. And so why wouldn't the players want the same situation and not be tied into a six-year deal, right, or a seven-year deal? Maybe they'd want to get to a three-year deal so they can capitalize on that rapid flow of money into the W.
Right. But also, this process has been so contentious, right? Like, do you want to ensure, I think, some measure of labor peace, right? Like, do you want to go through this, like, process in 3 years of a year of the players and owners publicly sniping at each other for all this time? Like, I don't think that's beneficial for the league either.
But I do think, like, if, say, the deal, you know, if the players could opt out or either side could opt out after 3 years, we'll say, like, you accept that now potentially because you recognize, back to your question about momentum, Mike, that, like, you want to, and it is important and imperative to continue the momentum that the league is on. That, look, we'll take the raises now and we'll basically expect to opt out in, you know, 2 or 3 years, and we'll do this all again and hope to continue to make significant changes then. Like, I don't think you can rule out that possibility. I know we're just, like, you know, spitballing. I don't think either of us have reporting to suggest that is on the table or going to happen, but I think that is another possible pathway that would make some sense. Like, you know, accept this now and almost fight another day in 2 years, 3 years, and continue to show growth. Because again, I think both sides recognize that this is just a booming period in the league, and nobody, you know, the league is not going to fold if they miss the start of the season. It's not going to fold if they miss half the season. I think 20 some odd years ago, if you got into labor strife in the WNBA and you missed games, that was definitely on the table. David Stern, the NBA commissioner at the early 2000s, when they were negotiating the 03 deal in the WNBA, basically threatened, like, basically said this, the fate of the league, the future of the league is at stake in these talks. Like, I don't think we've heard either side say that. I know we haven't. In terms of, like, will it actually cease to exist? But both sides recognize the importance of this moment kind of continuing to bloom, because people don't want to see the downside.
But does it matter if they miss games? Like, let's say they don't get a deal done by whatever their drop dead date is to start the season on time, right? Does it matter if they miss games? This is a league that's quickly changing in many ways, and that includes amongst its fans, right? The fan base is changing. A lot of the old fans who might have more equity with the league and who might be more willing to stay with the league and remain a fan, some of them are being priced out, right? You guys have written about that, how the changing nature, how about the success of the WNBA has changed who gets to watch these games in person. The new fans don't have the same history and the same bond with the league. Like, what if the fear is that some of these new fans that have come into the league in the last, 3-4 years, if they miss games, they don't want to stick with it. I don't know how real that is, but I feel like it has to at least be a concern that you lose some of these fans that you've gained over that time.
One thing I will say about the missed games is, like, on the NBA side, when you have a lockout and you don't get 82 games, like, there is a certain sense of, oh, like, the season feels different because there aren't 82 games. WNBA season length has changed like 5 times over the last 5 years. I don't think anybody is locked into, oh, there has to be 44 games or it doesn't feel like a full WNBA season. If you get to a point where there's an actual postseason, I don't think anybody's going to care if it took 30 games to get there or 50. Like, I don't think that there is the same sense of loss or like this is an incomplete season in that respect.
That's a really interesting point, especially considering that next year anyway, I think both of us expect, and we've reported this and talked about it some on our podcast, no offseason, which I can't believe it only took us 25 minutes to plug, Sabrina. That's what are we doing?
Was it not part of our introductions? Isn't that contractually mandated by us?
Yeah, I know. We should have done it earlier. Please listen to
Ben
our
Pickman
show.
Ben Pickman and Sabrina Merchant, who hosts No Offseason on the Athletic Podcast Network. Go subscribe and listen.
Thank you, Mike. You know, we've talked about how even if they were to reach a deal, next season's WNBA footprint is going to be different than what is currently the footprint, because not only is the league adding 2 more teams, which I think naturally is going to extend the season, but there is a World Cup, a tournament, an international FIBA tournament in Germany at the, I guess, end of August, start of September, I want to say is the timeline. And so it's going to push back very likely the start of the postseason, another 2 weeks. There might be a late season break, a la a usual Olympic break that pushes the finals not into, you know, moves the finals back from ending in mid-October to potentially early November. Who knows if I can run the New York City Marathon next year, Mike,
because of
the WNBA finals. That's really on the top of my priority list.
Didn't you fly to Berlin during the playoffs to run a marathon? It seems like you have your priorities during the finals.
yeah, exactly. No comment there. I'm hoping next year, Chicago Marathon, I've never run it. It is on my list, hoping I can get a spot that normally it falls during the finals, but maybe now it starts at the beginning of the playoffs next year. So, you know,
that's five of the finals this year.
Yeah. Right. That's top
of mind
for me.
Ben is texting the Sky GM and he's like, can you guys just get to the playoffs and host the game at this time? Like, I need you to do this for me.
No comment on who and what I am texting. But yeah, we'll leave it there. But yeah, we'll have a different footprint anyway. And so I think Sabrina's point about the schedule changing and people not being set to it, like, yeah, already we were going to have some change next year. So I think that's a really good point, too.
I wonder, you started off this podcast by calling it a cold war. Like, maybe this is a nuclear option. But, like, do the WNBA players need the WNBA is the question. Like,
I'm happy to go there. It's something I was thinking about.
I mean, like, the players have we've already seen that if the players start another league, people will go watch that league, right? Admittedly, it's a different setup. It's 3x3. It's not 5-on-5 in the same way, right? But like, if Caitlin Clark decided that she wanted to start her own league, don't you think people would watch that league?
Would that league have a Project B tie to it, Sabrina? Because I think we should. I asked that facetiously, but I think like it's an interesting thought experiment. I don't know if you have thoughts, Mike, as you were reporting out what you reported on Project B, like, you know, how does that tie in here potentially?
Yeah, I mean, listen, they want to start next fall, right? So that'll be outside the WNBA window. But I wonder if they had an opportunity to change the kind of maybe the framework of what that season looks like to take advantage of the opportunity. I mean, I kind of push back about Unrivaled kind of showing that people will watch a lot of these players. I think the ratings were somewhere in the mid to low 100,000s, right? Roughly 100,000 viewers per game, which is fine. It's good. But like, that's significantly less than what WNBA games were drawing. So I think the appeal for a lot of fans is still with the WNBA, right? Now, maybe that changes if the W is out of commission for a while and they know that's the only place to get their fix. But it seems like it would still be in the WNBA players' best economic interest to make sure the W works, because that's where they can get more salary, you know, theoretically under this new CBA. And then about Project B, I mean, I don't know if they're just coming in and dropping bags of cash for everybody, then forget the W and forget Unrivaled. Like, right, everyone start touring Asia and Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking about like the actual salary portion of it, because they already get more money in Unrivaled than they do in the WNBA, right? And that's set to change, obviously. Like, no matter what proposal they accept, it's going to be more money than the average, you know, salary that they're getting in Unrivaled. But I don't know, just the framework of the WNBA existing in this umbrella of the NBA forever tied to it. Like, I keep thinking about how NWSL was finally able to break free from the U.S. soccer of it all, and like how that has allowed the league to expand its business in a way that wouldn't have been possible like under that ownership umbrella. And I just wonder if the WNBA is ever going to be able to hit its full potential in this, again, this like structure where it doesn't own its own profits, you know?
I do want to say, I mean, about the Unrivaled thing, I think it's kind of interesting for a different reason. It could potentially kind of fracture the players a little bit, right? There are, you know, a number of the top players playing Unrivaled, but it's a league for the upper crust of the WNBA players union, right? Like, it's top players go there, earn those larger salaries. But the bottom half of the players don't necessarily get to profit from that. So I think of like the last NFL CBA talks, I think if I remember correctly, that CBA was not broadly popular with like the stars and the top players in the NFL, but it got passed because most of the rank and file saw it as a win for them, because that's where the majority of the benefits, the new benefits, improved benefits came from. I mean, I think that would be the case here too in the WNBA CBA. Like Nafisa Collier, Breonna Stewart, they have the ability to sit out. They have equity. They have large salaries. They could go play elsewhere. But if you're player number 10 on the roster, right, your options are much more limited. And if you want to especially play basketball in the United States instead of going abroad, whatever time of year, like, all right, maybe you don't get the max value for yourself and the max value for players in the new WNBA CBA. It could still be a big improvement, and that, you know, that's a potential fracture point for them.
Well, I think it's a really interesting point, because during the finals, and I don't think this was a term Sabrina and I had ever thought about in this context before, but like, we talked to Kalani Brown, who's a reserve center on the Phoenix Mercury, and she used the phrase of calling herself a tweener. And now Kalani Brown is a 6'7" center. She is by no means a positional tweener in terms of how she plays, but she is a tweener.
Put her in the NBA,
that's
a tweener, like combo forward kind of situation.
True.
Yeah.
But she is someone who describes herself as a tweener, as one of these kind of role players in the WNBA who, for so long, for, you know, since she's been in the league 5 or 6 years, more than that, I guess, has made her money playing abroad. And so she is a part, she is her team's, one of her team's union representatives, because she says, like, she, it is important for her to make sure that viewpoint of the role player who makes money overseas, who also plays in the W, she wanted to make sure that that viewpoint is, you know, properly heard from and has a voice in the room. And so I think that is a, you know, there are definitely some players like that who do have a say on the Players Association, even if some of the highest profile names on the executive committee are some of your biggest stars. There are role players on the EC, someone like Elizabeth Williams. Now, she is someone who, you know, is coming towards the end of her career, relatively speaking. She's on the EC. Or Alicia Clark, another player who has done alternative leagues. She's played overseas, coming towards the end of her career. She is far more of a role player than a upper echelon star. So there are role players on the executive committee who have their voices in the room. But you're right to call out that, you know, you have the Stewies, the Neco Gumekes, the Kelsey Plums, Satu Sabali, an important member of the bargaining committee. Like, those are some of the best players in the world who all very much have a loud voice here too.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about the tweener and like the fracture here is that what Kalani said is like, she's specifically part of a pre-NIL generation. So she didn't come into the WNBA with any money. And the players that are coming into the league now have money. They don't have to go overseas. They, like, especially the ones who are getting drafted in the WNBA, they did very well for themselves from a, you know, an NIL redshirt perspective when they were in college. And that specific generation of, like, the Kalani Brown, we also talked to Dana Evans, who was drafted in 2021, like, who were in college before they were able to profit off of their own name, image, and likeness. Like, I wonder how much that generation is going to get squeezed because they just don't represent a big part of the WNBA body anymore, right? Like, we're 4 years removed from that class. Like, how much are you going to advocate for that specific group of players who is not a superstar, but who also, like, didn't get to benefit from NIL versus the ones who are coming in now who are going to represent really the future of your league?
Yeah. And so that's why when you talk about max salaries, what's the median salary, right? Like, that's probably more important. I do wonder, and I've gone about 33 minutes into this podcast without saying this name, so I'm a little proud of myself, but like, this is something I've had in my head. Shouldn't we talk about the Caitlin Clark of it all? I can't imagine, if we're talking about the public perception war here, if Caitlin Clark, who I think has been pretty silent on this, were to come out and say something and get her fan base, her very large, very vocal fan base involved here, it could move things, you know, and potentially put more pressure on the NBA and the WNBA leadership that's negotiating the CBA on that side to get something done. And we haven't yet. Is that, I mean, what do you think of that? The most, inarguably the most popular and powerful player in the league has remained silent to this point.
I guess I just go back to one of the earlier questions you asked, Mike, is, yeah, I think that would make an impact on the public perception and the conversation and the noise around the agreement. But I don't know if the lawyers who are negotiating this contract for the WNBA, you know, NBA side, like, do they really care that, you know, that if Caitlin Clark were to say something to ignite even more public attention, is that going to move them at the bargaining table? You know, these are people who have worked on other contentious CBA negotiations. I imagine to get the roles that they have, they, you know, probably don't buck very often to public opinion or because of public opinion. I don't know. Like, I'm not sure. How much of an actual impact that would have.
Well, if you just think about the actual impact that Caitlin has had on the WNBA, it's unlike any other league we've seen before, right? So even if they have worked on previous CBAs, they've never dealt with an athlete who is as individually responsible for so much, I should just say, in the league that they're, working with, right? Yeah. I mean, like you said, Caitlin, I think, had a brief comment in her exit interview, after Nafisa Collier's exit interview. She had said that, generally expressed support for what Fee said, just that the player is, stand together, yada, 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 but nothing super concrete. I would think that a Caitlin messaging would move some people just because of what she means to the league. But I mean, you saw the way Kathy Engelbert reacted when her name was even brought up in the press conference, right? It clearly matters to her what her relationship is with Clayton Clark. So I would think that there is some understanding that hey, we're not playing favorites, but also there are people that matters to individually engage with. So I think she holds a lot more power than she's willing to exercise here.
Yeah. And I guess the question is, would she exercise it? Have there been discussions about having her exercise? I mean, I understand what you're saying, Ben, about these being steeled lawyers who live inside of the negotiating room and don't, care about what other people say. But you know who does? The people who run leagues, team owners. There's a lot of people involved in these things.
No, that's fair. I mean, it's definitely possible that, her speaking out ignites public reaction and friends of owners start to talk to owners and owners talk to other people at the league and other people at the league start to talk. And there's this, trickling effect from person to person to person that then gets to the bargaining table and does make a difference. I genuinely I'm not sure, how significant it would be. I think we should also say too, another possibility here after this extension or if this extension expires is just a period of status quo, right? It's not just a immediate work stoppage, a lockout or strike. I mean, both sides could, the players could decide to strike, announce a strike. The league could lock the players out after 30 days if a new deal isn't reached. But there is also this just potential, status quo period is the legal term that both are in, where there's an expired agreement that just kind of exists and they're continuing to talk and we'll see how it progresses. I think that's important just because it's just another scenario here that I think we're watching for as we think about this conversation around leverage and power, that I don't know who has the upper hand there. Is there an upper hand? If they enter a period of status quo, what does that mean for leverage going forward? Because either side can just kind of announce and make a decision accordingly. That's why all of this is so tricky.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think the other thing that's probably tricky that we haven't addressed yet is that, I think the presumption and all the messaging that we've gotten so far is that the WNBA is not a league that makes money and teams generally don't make money. And again, and we all know that they have a new media rights deal kicking in for the 2026 season, which, by the way, some of that money might get impacted if there are no games. Just FYI, those are dependent on games being played. Does it matter if the W is losing money? Is that a thing that is significant here? And I know that might sound like a stupid question, and I'm sure if someone from the WNBA were listening, they might be annoyed by me even framing it that way. But I remember I was talking to someone who was interested in buying a WNBA team, and they were okay with, the team that they were interested in losing money, because they said the value to them over time was the valuation of the team going up and what they would eventually sell it for, whether it's 2x, whatever they bought it for, 4x, I don't know, whatever, do your own projections, right? But that was the value of buying that team financially, was what they would eventually sell it for. And so if you have some people who are buying into teams and with the intent to eventually sell and make their huge sum of profit in that way, then is it less relevant if teams and the league are losing money in the short term?
And that's an argument that we have heard some players come out and say, look, it doesn't matter if you lose $5 million a year for the next 5 years or the next 10 years, because you bought this team X owner for $2 million, for $5 million, for $10 million. And assuming this WNBA continues to grow, whether it's at the rate of the last couple of years or just at a significant rate going forward, that in 15 years and 20 years, well, you're going to sell the team you bought for $2 million for, $500, $600, $700, the New York Liberty this summer were valued at $450 million. I know I had some people talk to me when I reported that number 10 years ago or 15 years ago when the Golden State Warriors were sold, when Joe Lacob and Peter Guber bought the Golden State Warriors. They bought the team for $450 million. And what's the valuation of the Warriors right now? Like a multiple billion, $4 billion, Mike? Like some crazy...
I mean, more relevantly, when the Size bought the Liberty, they've already got like what? 40, 50x return, theoretically, right. If they want to cash
and,
out more.
And so if you give it another 10 years, the Liberty could be worth $1 billion. And so if an owner wants to cash out there, well, like, you know, $1 billion is a hell of a lot more than $10 million, you know? Like, it doesn't matter if you lose a couple million dollars each year in theory when you cash out on that investment. Or that is an argument that is made.
It kind of just seems like there's like a double standard when it comes to women's sports versus men's sports. Like, you rarely hear on the other side, like with other businesses, like there's an understanding that you put money in and sometimes like it takes a little while to get it back out. But I mean, I don't hear NBA owners complaining about how much, like, there's just like a proof of concept required with women's sports that doesn't seem to exist with men's sports. Mm. Like, the XFL has been tried 13 times and we just keep going with it, even though like it doesn't work. How much money has been thrown in the XFL? If you just put that money in the WNBA, like, we wouldn't have any of these problems.
I will say, I think in the 2011 CBA talks, the reason there was a lockout and why the share of the revenue share that the players got went down from 57% to this 49 to 51% band was, there was claims that teams were losing money, right? And that's kind of what led to this situation. I think it's not an argument in the NBA anymore, or the NFL, or I mean, we'll see what happens to baseball. But like, the teams just aren't losing money anymore. Like, all these things, not only have their valuations go up so much, it's that they're also profiting every year, unless you're, you know, in the second apron and paying luxury tax and repeater tax. But at that point, back in like 2011, that was right before the great valuation boom, right? So maybe that was more of a short-term concern about how much money you were making and whether you were profiting every year, because you didn't know if you bought a team for $300 million that you'd be able to, you know, like the Celtics were bought for $360 in 2002 and then sold for $6.7 combined a few decades later, like 25 years later. Like, what you did then wasn't as obvious now, whereas even in the W, you can probably say, hey, I bought this team for, you know, $100 million, this expansion team, I'll probably be able to sell it. Or you have the Valkyries for $50 million. Like, if they want to sell it in a few years, they can sell it now. They would have a great return on their investment. Like, if you invested in that as a, you know, as an LP, you're good. You're set. You're making nice money already. All right. So I have a question for you. And this is how I'm going to end this podcast. I'm going to put you on the hot seat. And I thought of it on the fly. So I'm going to ask you without any prior warning, what date do we get a resolution to these CBA talks, and where, give me the general contours of where you think that deal ends up?
I can take this first. I think the players are going to accept a massive salary increase that doesn't necessarily include the revenue share piece that they're hoping for, because they want to keep the league going. And I think that it's going to take a while to get them to that point. So probably like February 22nd-ish is where I'm landing.
February 22nd, right around President's Day. Okay.
Yeah. that's what I was thinking, Mike.
Ben, what do you think?
I tend to agree with Serena on the framework component. I think the revenue system will change a little bit from what is currently in the agreement. But I do think, I do wonder, just like, is there a point where the number that players could get paid in terms of salary is so high that they're willing to say, look, we'll take that now. We will concede a little bit on the framework. We'll hope for a shorter deal so we can renegotiate in a couple years. And we'll take the wins now, and we'll also live to fight another day down the road. In terms of timing, I mean, Sabrina said, I was going to initially say February 28th, but since you said the 22nd, I'll push it back a little bit. I'll go with the nice round. Everyone loves a mid-month. I'll go with March 15th.
All right, but remember, we are playing Price is Right rules. I just dropped that in mid-conversation too. Okay. So you have to respond to that.
Got it.
I should say, like, just to clarify, massive salary, I think that's going to mean a max of like 1.5.
Yeah.
Max of 1.5. Okay.
Yes. I think we're
so like that's 6x of where they currently are in a maximum salary.
That'll be, I mean, If I were to tell you,
I think the band would be like 500 to 1.5, where they're willing to like give up the revenue share and just take full on salary increase.
500 being the minimum salary?
Yeah. Yeah. Right, so like basically 6x on both ends. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to make a guess that the minimum salary is somewhere around $350,000. Goes up potentially up to $1.75 million.
Wow.
And I'm going to say...
Well, it's good to be prices right at it. At least I got the max lower.
Well, to me, it's almost a question of like, which set of players do you want to try to isolate a little bit and see if you can win over, right? Like, if you... And maybe I'm actually gaming it out wrong. Maybe they can set the max salary lower and bring up, to your point, Sabrina, like bring up the minimum salary higher and just win over more people. If you're someone who's been making $100,000 and they tell you, hey, you can make a minimum of $500,000 next year, and that affects a much larger swath of the player group than it does the max salary. Like, I don't know, that sounds pretty good to me.
It's also important just to think of the size of the player body, right? Like in the NFL, the rank and file make up so many more people, but we're only talking about 150 players in the WNBA. So the superstars make up a bigger percentage of the WNBA, I think, than other leagues.
And it is easier then to communicate messaging. It's easier to get players on calls. It's easier to rally support. I mean, I think everyone saw at All-Star the demonstration that the players put on wearing the Pay Us What You Owe Us shirts. Yeah, that was significant for the All-Stars. But a couple of days earlier, there was a notable CBA meeting in Indianapolis, you know, at a hotel. Sabrina and I both waited in the hallway and waited and waited and waited and waited. And there were like more than 40 players, a record number, who attended that meeting. Well, more than 40 players, that represents nearly a quarter of the body.
Third.
Like, that's pretty significant when you think about support at an in-person meeting. That was the most that the players have ever had at one of these meetings before. It's a lot less that you have to manage. I mean, I remember reporting out a story a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago on kind of the thought of a work stoppage. I talked to a lawyer who worked for the MLBPA. And she was describing how they used the media in the mid-90s. And she said, more than anything else, they used the media as a means to communicate with their body, because it was like a surefire way to get people to like hear what the Players Association was saying. I don't think the WNBA, the WNBPA has that problem just because of the size of the overall body.
Yeah, I mean, apathy is sometimes an issue for players' unions, right? Even during the course of negotiations, that not all their players care, that not all their players are invested, that not all the players know what they're voting on. Like, that's not an issue in the WNBA right now. They seem to be heavily invested, heavily motivated, heavily involved, and that's I would say that's great for the WNBPA. I'm kind of curious where it goes. I'm going to go with March 19th. As the deal date. Is that
enough?
Do
you know what day of the week that is? Like, as we just take random guesses at things, Mike, do you want to take a guess? Is it a Thursday?
I'm going to say it's a Thursday. I'm going to change my calendar
now
to Thursday.
I
got to
know
no
what date mine is.
Is that enough time to
I've talked to some front office people and like they have an understanding that they could breeze through some things as long as they know that like this is the window we're working with. So, you know, we could see an expedited offseason, I'm sure.
Yeah, they all know, as long as they don't change the CBA too much, right? And what rules they'll be playing on there. You just have to fit in two expansion drafts, a draft lottery, an actual draft, free agency, a trade period, and a training camp, probably in like under 2 months. That seems easy.
Doable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sabrina, Ben, thank you for doing this podcast. I really appreciate it. If you haven't yet, read them at The Athletic. Listen and subscribe to their podcast, No Off Season. Is there anything else you want to plug? Is there any kind of side project? Do you have an art show coming up? Like, is there anything? Are you running a race for charity? Is there anything that anyone else listening
to
this should know about?
If you happen to pick up the New York Times this week, Ben's name would have been in it as one of the New York Marathon finishers. So you can look for him there.
That is true. I did also have a byline in the paper on the same day that my own athletic accomplishment was recognized.
Big day for Ben Pickman.
That is pretty cool. Sabrina, Dodgers fan coming off a big weekend. That should be said, but she feels the affinity with the team.
Yeah.
We can't support the dot. No,
that's... Look, I think, Mike, we've done a lot of CBA conversations. This might have been the only one to include references to both Beşiktaş and the Men's Euroleague in Turkey.
I should clarify, it was Olympiakos for Josh Childress. I just want to end on a proper note there.
We'll run a correction in the podcast. I'm sorry, listeners, if you haven't gotten to this point or you're operating on the wrong information. Thank you, Sabrina. That's actually very vital. We want to make sure we have no mistakes. I'm sure if anyone from the WNBA or the WNBPA has been listening to this and is not happy with what we said, some of us, hopefully you too, may hear from them too. Everyone, thank you for watching and listening to Business Decision. I'm Mike Vorkunov. We'll catch you guys on the next episode. Please subscribe and leave a very kind review. Bye.